Well, good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. It is 8:19 in the studio this morning on this 27th day of December. We have Utah Representatives Tim Quinn and Brian King. They're here to talk about the tax overhaul bill that was just passed in a special session in December. And we've got Tilly, our mascot dog, who is really pushing for quite a lot of attention.
And getting it, yes.
And welcome. Thank you for joining us, Brian King and Tim Quinn. Appreciate you coming in.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, so the Utah legislature passed a sweeping tax overhaul during a December special session. Joining us now, we've got District 54. Tim is from District 54 and Brian King, House Minority Leader. Tim, Brian, you both voted against this tax bill, and I don't know if that happens very often with both of you being on different sides.
It ought to scare one of the two of us.
I've been a good influence on Tim.
Different sides of the aisle. Yes, yes. So now the basics of this legislation is that the income tax reduction is going from 4.95% to 4.65%, and some tax credits for Social Security, low-income taxpayers, and deductions for dependents, restoring the full sales tax on food, and I think that's probably a sticking point for many, and adding sales tax to gas, as well as a handful of services that will now be taxed. Brian, why don't we start with you? What was the defining problem for you with this bill?
Well, there were a couple of things that bothered me. One is, whenever you reduce the income tax, you're taking money straight out of the education fund. Our state constitution requires that all money raised from our income tax, whether it's paid by corporations or individuals, goes into the education fund. It's allocated specifically for not just public education, but for higher education. So it's troubling to me, it was troubling to me, that we had such a significant reduction, several hundred million dollars a year in reduction for how we pay for education in this state. That was number one. And number two, I didn't like the idea of increasing sales tax on food in a way that had the biggest impact on those who are most vulnerable.
Yeah, so just a clarification with the education impacts, there was a statement that a constitutional attorney had issued to the school districts, I guess asking for input, that was brought to us by our business administrator from Park City School District, basically saying that there was an intention and that, of course, changing that allocation of money coming out of the income tax will have to be done through the voters' initiative in the ballot box. But there was some discussion that that amount of money would be secured going forward and put into a constitutional, basically constitutional amendment that would allow that education funding to continue from now into the future, accommodating for inflation as well as student growth. Tim, can you talk about that, or are you familiar with that?
I'm not, actually. Let me, if I can, just piggyback on what Brian said just a moment ago. You asked what specifically did we not like about the bill that made us vote no, and Brian gave you two examples. I'll just say the bill itself. We went into this 20 months ago, or I went into this 20 months ago, looking to change our tax structure in the state to match the change in economy. We've really not had any major changes to the tax policy since the 30s, when we first implemented as a state sales tax on goods. And as I've talked many times, not only on this show but others, we don't spend our money the same as we used to. We don't buy as many goods as we used to. We've changed to services. So I thought the intent, and if you look at the language of the task force when we were first organized, the intent was to adapt a tax policy that met the changing economy. And I don't think we did that at all. We took the two easiest roads, and that is sales tax on food and sales tax on gasoline, to kind of shift money out of the income tax fund, which Representative King talked about, into the general sales tax fund. But if you look at food and unprepared food and gasoline, both of those are declining commodities. So we've hung our revenue hat on the two biggest declining pieces of the old economy, if you will. We buy way more prepared food than we used to and less unprepared food. And I got some statistics from the federal government, which that's challenging in and of itself. But over the next 10 years, we're going to lose 23% of the revenue that we receive off of tax, whether it be an excise tax or sales tax on gasoline. that's hundreds of millions of dollars that we're going to be without just in the next decade because of fuel efficiency and the advent and I think migration towards EVs. So all we've done is buy ourselves time. Some would argue 5 to 7 years. I think we don't even do that. One of the things that bothered me, Carolyn, the most, and I think Brian was in the meeting that I spoke about this, is we were assured from certain people on the task force that all of the money shifted out of the education fund and put into the general sales tax fund, which I think was $534 million, would be used to pay for higher education, therefore holding public education harmless. That's not true. We are not going to spend $534 million on higher education. That is an appropriations bill, as Representative King knows better than I do. And I believe that once we get in there, we're probably going to be looking at $350 to $400 million of that money going to higher education, therefore affecting public education to the tune of $150 to $200 million in the negative. And I don't think it was presented well. I don't think it was altruistic in the way it was presented. So there were a lot of things I didn't agree with the bill. And sales tax on food is something I fought against and actually ran a bill 2018 to do away with. So I just didn't like the process or the bill itself.
So why would a sales tax on food affect? I mean, when you're talking about prepared foods, going to restaurants, eating out, that type of thing, we're still taxing those.
Correct.
Those services or those resources. But how does that even out? Does the sales tax on food combined with that end up coming to the same numbers ultimately?
Well, it's adding revenue to the state coffers, just adding, going from 1.75 to 4.85 on unprepared food or grocery store food. It's adding, I think the number was $240 million to the state coffers. Now, to the task force credit, to those who voted in favor of the bill and put the bill together, there is a tax credit for low-income people, low- and middle-income people, to offset that increase. But to me, that's adding another government program, and I don't like doing that. But this was the easy road, and oftentimes the easy road is not the best road to take.
And what's the basis upon which there's such a movement to take to lower the income tax rate, Brian?
Well, I think that the greatest growth that we've seen in state revenues have clearly come from income tax in the last 5 to 10 years. That's the healthiest source of revenue, stream of revenue for the state. And the feeling was that we've done so well in Utah over the last, since the Great Recession, that it's now time for a tax cut for those who have done so well and contributed so much. I get that in the sense that nobody likes taxes, but the reality is that we have failed to move the needle in a significant way in terms of how we've invested in particularly public education here in Utah. We're still at the very bottom of the list. I mean, some people say Idaho has fallen behind us. We've overtaken Idaho. Well, great, but we're still 50th instead of 51st when you include the District of Columbia. We've got a long way to go in terms of investing in our kids in the way that we need to. So that was one thing that bothered me about reducing the income tax. So to answer your question, the reason that they were targeting income tax is that's been the healthiest stream of income. And I think, quite honestly, there are a number of people that feel that we can get along just fine being 50th in the country in terms of how we fund our public education. But it isn't hurting our children. I disagree with those folks, but there are folks up in the legislature who feel that way.
So there was a Democrat proposed tax bill that was put together. It was kind of a message bill that came through, I guess, was it this month, earlier this
month?
Yeah,
it was about a week before the special session.
Okay, and Republican leadership really wanted the tax task force chair's bill to pass. They wanted this one to go through. But what suggestions from the Democrats' proposal would improve the state's tax law altogether?
Well, one of the things that we were proposing is to put in place the same tax cut that was proposed by the Republican majority for those making $150,000 and less on the income tax side, but to put in place a progressive income tax, incremental progressive income tax for people making more than $150,000 a year. Our feeling is that those who have done well and continue to do well should step up to the plate a little more and make greater contributions to public and higher education. The other thing that we were proposing to do, and I think in some ways the most important aspect of the bill, was to scrap our state sales tax system and put in place a gross receipts tax. That is something that we talk about all the time as lawmakers and as policymakers up in the legislature dealing with budgets and taxes, is broaden the base, lower the rate.
So what does that mean, a gross receipts tax?
It would broaden the base and lower the rate in this way. Right now, sales taxes are, as Tim points out, not applied to, few services have sales taxes applied to them. And what we've done basically is targeted a very limited aspect of our economic activity to impose sales taxes on. A gross receipts tax is going to broaden the base and lower the rate because it will make sure that any business, whether they're providing services or goods, has a relatively small percentage. In our proposal, it was 0.9%, less than 1%, of their gross receipts that they would have pay a tax on. It would hit lawyers, it would hit doctors, it would hit real estate agents, it would hit accountants, it hit me. I have my own small law firm. I'm the sole owner of my own law firm. I'd pay taxes under this that I don't pay now. But it would be fair, it would be broadening the base and lowering the rate in a way that would capture almost all economic activity in a way that our current sales tax structure doesn't.
So, Tim, can you talk a little bit, please, about the Republican colleagues that also voted against that bill? You're not the only Republican, I believe.
No, I think there were, if memory serves me correctly, there were 9 of us that voted against, all 16 Democrats, and I think there were 9 Republicans. As to why, Carolyn, I really can't answer that. I didn't have much discussion with them prior to or certainly after the vote was taken. But I think if I had to kind of guess, take a stab at it, it's because the bill did not do what we set out to do, and that was conform our tax policy to the economy that we now all live in. So Brian talked about a gross receipts tax. That's something we looked at last year in the session with my bill 441. It's interesting. He said 0.9. We came up with 0.87, which is pretty close. Mm-hmm. It would have been taxing, I think, $325 billion worth of economic output in the state. There is a problem or a concern with that that we looked at, and one of the reasons we backed away from it is, one, it's so sweeping that really would have been making a major change in a short period of time. But the other is tax pyramiding that we talk about a lot, taxing business inputs. There's a way to get around that with a value-added tax, which accomplishes the same thing. You just strip away taxes that have previously been paid. But yes, I would be much more in favor of looking at those type systems, or at least expanding the base to the point of services without business inputs being taxed. We could lower the rates significantly so that it does involve more people in the process. We could eliminate the sales tax on food completely. There are a lot of things that we could have done that we didn't. But as to why the other 8 Republicans voted no, I really couldn't tell you.
Yeah. So it looks like there has been some bipartisan support from the gubernatorial candidates to overturn the bill. I guess there's a discussion about a referendum. But how will that make any difference? Let's say it does go on the ballot and it passes by, through the voter initiative. But we've seen in the past that the legislature basically, rewrites that or reforms that referendum once it comes through, as we saw with a number of propositions last year. I'd love to hear both of your comments on that.
Well,
I'll defer to the senior representative in so many ways.
Yeah, sure, you always do. That referendum faces a real steep hill to climb because you got to gather over 100,000 signatures in about 40 days. So before the end of January, they're going to have to come up with a really significant number of folks who sign off on it. I know there are efforts underway to do it, and maybe they'll get there. I wouldn't mind seeing that on the ballot. I would like to see, if that referendum got enough signatures and qualified for the ballot, we would be voting in November on what we voted on in this last special session, is my understanding. And if that was true, I'd say, let's see what the people of the state of Utah think. One of the other groups of people that are really going to get hard by what we just passed in the special session are those who put a lot of miles on their car, assuming that they don't have electric cars, and that's because we raised the gas tax. That's going to have a disproportionately negative impact on people in rural Utah. Now, I don't represent a lot of rural Utah. I represent a little bit of Summit County. I guess you could count that as rural. But, I do think it's disproportionately impacting what we did in the special session. Again, people who are most vulnerable, whether they're rural Utahns who are not always, of course, but many of them whom are struggling to make ends meet, or whether it's folks who are working to literally put food on the table. I just think it was a disproportionately regressive move that we made in our tax policy in the last special session.
Yeah. Tim, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't like ballot initiatives for any reason. Even though I voted no for this bill, I was a strong no on this bill. I still just don't think that's the best way to legislate, but it will be interesting. It's my understanding that there are three organizations. They've now kind of teamed up, so maybe they will have a chance to, I think it's 116,000 signatures by January 26th or something like that. So it'll be interesting to watch. As far as rewriting what the voters do, I would disagree somewhat with that, Carolyn, because in the last two that you were referring to, Medicaid and medical marijuana, Medicaid was a budget issue. We have to balance the budget. Some would argue we could have just raised taxes even further to do that. And the medical marijuana we won't get into, but it had to do with recreational marijuana, whether that bill covered all the bases with that. But in this bill, I would find it difficult to believe that the legislature, if it made it on the ballot and if the ballot were to pass, we would revert back to where we were prior to the special session. We would have to take another stab at it because we do have a structural problem in the state of Utah. But to go back to what this bill did with raising sales tax on food and sales tax on gasoline, I would find it difficult that we as a legislature would do that.
What will this food sales tax and gasoline and tax mean to, or gasoline tax mean to the average consumer? Is there any number out there that, you know, it's going to be, you know, $50 more a month for a family of four? I mean, what can people expect?
I don't know what the numbers are on that.
The legislative fiscal analyst did an incidence of tax where we look at every income group and size of family. And again, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. While I was a strong opponent to the bill, the incidence of tax was pretty evenly spread out. Those making below $30,000 and those making above $150,000 all had a tax cut. The people who were probably harmed the most by the bill, I think there was statistically 84% of taxpayers in Utah received a tax cut and 16% saw no cut or a slight rise in their taxes. Most of those were either single filers or married couples with no children. Outside of that, I think most people will benefit because of the certain offsets. I travel about 25,000 miles a year. I live in Heber and work in Lehigh. I put a lot of miles on my car. I will be affected drastically by the sales tax on gas. That's not why I didn't vote for it. I'm okay with paying more taxes if I use a service like gasoline, but it's just a declining commodity and it was a bad choice to make.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk just a little bit about what's happening next session. What bills do you anticipate will emerge during this 2020 session, general session?
Well, we had a special session a year ago and on medical marijuana, as Tim referenced, and I remember the speaker at that time, Greg Hughes, saying to me, this is the last thing we're going to do on this. We're not going to touch it anymore. We've since had a special session, another one, on medical marijuana, and we messed around with it in the last general session. So I say that because I think we're going to continue to see bills on tax reform. I just don't think that what we did in the last special session is a cure-all for that. And, of course, in any special or any general session, you're going to see a lot of budget bills, a lot of issues involving our state budget, because that's the only thing constitutionally that we have to do is put together a state budget for the next fiscal year. So budget issues and tax issues, I think, are going to be prominent. I also think we're going to see some bills associated with some of the current issues, such as gun violence reduction. I'm running a couple of bills on that. I know a couple of my Republican colleagues are. Representative Handy's got his red flag bill. So I think that those are the kind of things that I look forward to dealing with.
Yeah. What about Tim, the census coming up, 2020 census and the impacts on redistricting? Will that be discussed? That was a referendum also this fall.
Right. And I would be surprised if there wasn't at least one bill. I think that was Proposition 4. I'll be surprised if there's not at least one bill addressing that. As far as the redistricting, that would occur in the legislative session of 2021. But I think I heard on the radio yesterday, there's already 20 some odd bills filed or opened concerning vaping, all the way from completely making it illegal in any form to anybody to just shoring up some loopholes that allow minors to purchase it right now or flavored or whatever. But I think vaping will be a big issue. But I think Brian's right. The biggest overarching umbrella issue will be taxes. And do we tweak it? Do we scrap it? Do we fix it? How do we manage it? But it'll be a big issue.
But can we just maybe wrap up also to let our listeners understand what the impacts are to them? Because there will have to be, if we're changing the way income tax is distributed, we do have to put that out for a constitutional amendment change.
Right. Well, one of the things that we do, Carolyn, on that is we can change without changing the Constitution the rates of income tax all we want, which is one reason that people have said that earmark on income tax really doesn't give a lot of security to public education because the legislature can do exactly what we did in the last session without government or without people's input in the on the general vote. We can change that income tax rate in a way that really reduces the money going into the education fund, and that's what we did. But you raise a good point, which is the legislative leadership has said we want to address how we deal with income tax and education funding. There may very well be something that passes for a November vote that removes the earmark and puts something else in place to provide greater assurance or provide some assurance that education funding is going to be increased or at least maintained. We don't know what form that's going to take yet. Senator Milner, Ann Milner over in the Senate, has sort of been tasked, from my understanding, with coming up with something that will allow us to talk in the general session about what, if anything, we discuss to basically take off the earmark on the education fund and replace it with something else.
Sure. And to Representative King's point, first of all, we as a legislature have to pass with a 50 vote margin, whether or not that constitutional earmark will even be on the ballot. If we don't pass it with 50 votes, it won't even go to a vote in November.
Yeah, two-thirds in each chamber.
Two-thirds in each chamber.
That's correct.
Equaling 50.
50 in the House and 20 in the Senate.
Okay.
I have argued since I've been in the legislature that this earmark, this educational earmark, is not even a very good security blanket. It shouldn't even give us warm fuzzies about public education because of what Brian just said. We can, and we have, done whatever we wanted to do with the income tax rate. So there is no security. There is no guarantee. What I would prefer to see, and I made this point last year to a working group at the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce involving education, is let's set a minimum, a floor of the entire state budget. Last year it was $19 billion. Let's look at what we've spent over the last 20 years, average it out, and say, okay, we're never going to go below this floor as a percentage of state budget. So in good years, which we've been on a roll with lately, public education would greatly benefit. And in the lean years, it doesn't mean we can't provide more funding. It's just we'll never go below a floor. And I think the figure was roughly, for ballpark figures, around 30% of the entire state budget would be spent on public education, no matter what. That does two things. One, it gives them a true guarantee. And secondly, it allows us as a legislature to look at our tax policy in a holistic way instead of looking at it in these silos where whatever we do to income tax affects public education. So we have to always be cognizant of that when we look at property taxes and sales taxes. Let's look at it in one ball of wax and say that no matter what we do, it's not going to negatively affect public education because we've set aside this minimum of the entire state budget. I think that's a true guarantee.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there.
And Brian's not saying anything, but I know he agrees wholeheartedly.
Well, it sounds like you two need to rest up because tell us again when the legislative session begins.
Is it the 27th, Tim? Yeah, Monday the 27th for 45 calendar days. So it'll end the middle of March. But you're right. It is a hectic time frame. They're long weeks, long days, and we enjoy it. We wouldn't do it unless we enjoyed it. And it's nice to be able to have an opportunity to serve the public and provide a positive direction, hopefully, for the future of Utah.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you come in like
Thank
this
you.
Over
Enjoyed
this
it.
Holiday time. Thanks so much. That's Tim Quinn and Brian King, House Representatives for Park City, sections of Park City. Thanks so much for coming by. And we're going to bring you Mo Hickey and Syriac Alvarez with Voices for Utah Children. They're here to talk about fee increases for DACA renewals. And just a reminder, deferred action for childhood arrivals. These prices are going up starting the first of the year. And we've got some people here to talk about that. Good morning. Thanks for coming by, Mo and Syriac. Thank you so much for being in here.
Good morning, Carolyn.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so who would like to start? Give us a recap of what the renewal guidelines are and how much is it increasing?
So I guess I can start. So there's going to be a rule change to DACA applications, to legal permanent residency applications, to citizen applications. So it's not just DACA, but like a wide variety of different application fees for immigration that are going to increase. DACA specifically is going to go up from $495 every 2 years to $765 every 2 years. That's a really big increase. I believe the citizenship application is going to go from $1,000 to like $2,000. And all that money that's going to be used for ICE and adding to detentions and to deportations, which is really frustrating.
How are you able to determine that that's where the money's going? Is that something that's a public document that you that any person could find out?
Yeah. It's specifically stated in the rule change that they have out. If you go onto the website where they allow for public comment, which is open until December 30th, you can look at the document and it'll say what the money's going to be used for.
So how many, maybe you know the answer to this, but how many renewals would we be expecting in the, say, this year throughout the state? And
There are about 10,000 DACA recipients here in Utah, and it's every 2 years, so maybe about half, 5,000. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to say for sure, but I know that because it is every 2 years that they're reapplying, it's probably about half or a little less than half.
Okay, and what do those young people do about covering the cost of that, Mo? Do you want to talk about
that?
Well,
that's one of the problems we're seeing right now. Since they announced this fee increase, we've seen a spike in requests for funding and assistance in funding. You know, a lot of the majority of the applicants are currently students. That's one of the requirements. You have to either be a student, you have to be in the workforce, you have to be in the military. Right, those are the three main requirements. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at people that aren't, in high-paying jobs for the most part, students working part-time trying to support themselves. So since they announced these fee increases, we have our program where we've been helping fund renewals, and we've seen a spike in requests immediately because we're not sure the exact date the new fees go into effect. I don't think they've announced the exact date yet. Mm-hmm. It's 2020, though, in the beginning of the year. So, but the problem is you can only renew 6 months in advance. It has to be in that six-month window. So if you're between now and end of May, we're getting a lot of those people come to us and say, I want to get my renewal in before the fee increase. I mean, that's a 60-65% fee increase on a burden that's already been pretty onerous on the people that need the application fee.
Yeah. So yeah. What typically would a fee increase be for this type of a?
Last time it increased, the DACA application was like $450 and it went up to $495.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So before it was a lot less, and now we're seeing over 50% increases for more than DACA applications, but for all applications. And they're doing away with the fee waiver application for all applications. So that means that people who can't afford, whether it's a legal permanent residency, asylum, citizenship, or DACA, or, U visas or VAWA, which is the Victims Against Women's Act, they won't be able to request a fee waiver for any of this, even if they would qualify with this rule change.
And how did this change get initiated? Was it through Congress or was it just an administrative through the White House?
Yep, it was the Trump administration. They announced a rule change on November 14th.
Okay. Now, the administration did shut down in 2017. They shut down the DACA program for new recipients. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that background and what happened there and what comes next?
Well, that's what we're really concerned about. Even just here locally, I had a teacher reach out to me last week and asked, because we had some students that never had applied for DACA that are eligible in the high school. And there's nothing that can be done for them at the moment. So the only thing after that ruling in 2017 was that renewals would still be accepted as it went through the courts. So right now, the Supreme Court heard the oral arguments in October? No, November. Mm-hmm. And we're expecting a ruling in the spring on the status of DACA moving forward. The oral arguments did not go as well as we would have hoped, at least on the surface. So it'll be a challenge as we head into the springtime to see where the court's going to come down on this.
And what are these children doing now?
So,
who are trying to get into college and trying to get jobs and graduate out of high school? And
yeah, I mean, most there are surveys that were done of DACA recipients, and most people who have DACA are either working or going to school full time or part time. And then people who don't have DACA, they're because of the way it was set up, like in 2017, it ended. Most of those young people are either in high school, have just graduated high school. My little cousin is one of them. She's 20 and she can't really work and can't really go to school because she can't afford to go to school because she doesn't have DACA to be able to help pay for it. So they're kind of in a limbo for the most part. And we're seeing more and more young people, like as they go through high school, just kind of like feel very differently, because when I was in high school, I received DACA and I obtained DACA my senior year. And now we're seeing these young people, they're graduating high school and they don't have a worker's permit. They don't have this sort of hope that young people like me did when I was graduating.
Yeah, sure. So you're on a renewal program mm-hmm, right now. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little broader about what Congress is doing, because it has been reported that it's got bipartisan support to address the issue of children who arrived here with their parents at such a young age that they could not have made any decisions for themselves. They were minors. What is happening in Congress?
You know, unfortunately, and I've said this before, I think it's become so much of a political issue, even though there is bipartisan support. Park City Municipal, not last summer, the summer before, we had representatives from Senator Lee's office, from Senator Hatch at the Times office, from Congressman Bishop's office, come up and meet with us and a group of community members up here. And everybody expressed their desire to have a DACA program. Also, the history of DACA is that it started in Utah. It started, actually, the first DACA recipient was from Park City High School. So, you know, there is support. The program actually has proven to work. If you wanted to look at pretty much any immigration program out there, DACA is the one. There's biometric screening. You have to have like I mentioned earlier, you have to have a job. You have to be in school. You have to be in the military. You have to renew every 2 years. You can only have 3 misdemeanors. You can't have a felony. It's a system that actually works, and it's been proven to work. It gives employers confidence when they're hiring somebody. The real question is there really a political will? Is there a bipartisan support of this? Because I would argue that they should take DACA, not only expand it, but it should become our immigration program across all levels. It should just be, and I would say we should expand it too, that you don't have to renew every 2 years with a fee. Even at the $495, that was an expensive fee to be renewing every 2 years for a young person who's in school. But make it a 5-year renewal or something like that. But with the same criteria that you have to, you can't have a felony and you can only have 3 misdemeanors. I think that there was a report out that less than 1% of all DACA recipients had been disqualified because of a felony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's such a minuscule amount compared to the big picture.
You said less than 4%?
Less than 1%.
Oh, less than 1%.
Yeah.
Okay.
I once had somebody up here in Park City joke that, and it was a joke, that half the town couldn't qualify for DACA if you actually went through everything with all the screening and everything.
Yeah.
But it's really a great program. And as Sirach said, the key to it is it's given these students and young people hope. That's really the key to the whole thing. I mean, we're going through it right now locally here. We're seeing it across the state. Is if you're a young student who either doesn't have a DACA and was eligible, or you're in that that group that's right behind the cutoff point for DACA students, mm-hmm. now you have no hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's contributing to one of the things we're seeing in the high truancy rates in some school districts right now. We're seeing chronic absenteeism go up across the state. And I'm not saying it's directly related to that, but there is some effect taking place there. If you don't have a hope for a future, and we're trying to tell these students, come to school and don't worry, everything's going to work out, it's a hard sell.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about the path to citizenship for DACA recipients? Sirik, you are a DACA mm-hmm. recipient. Is there a path for you?
Not currently. Currently, the way the DACA program is set up is only a worker's permit. It was only supposed to be a temporary solution while Congress figured out how to create a permanent solution for over 1 million, 2 million Dreamers. But right now, there isn't a pathway for someone like me to be able to become a citizen. If the DREAM Act or the Dream and Promise Act or one of the many different acts that have been out there and different legislations that have been out there passed, it would create a permanent solution, a pathway to citizenship for a lot of people. So unless Congress acts, there's really no way for someone like me to obtain citizenship.
And a state can't operate independently when it comes to immigration. They can't make their own plans and choices. I mean, just
yeah,
know, no 10,000 kids who are here currently.
No, so Utah can do things like in-state tuition, which we have, but when it comes to immigration, because it is a federal issue, only the federal government, so only our federal delegation can really take lead on that.
Okay. Anything else that you want to talk about with the DACA changes that are coming along here?
No, it's been very frustrating. It seems, you know, you raised the point, is it bipartisan? And yet these things are, you know, very arbitrary when they come down. I mean, there was a really good article, I think it was on the HuffPost a couple of days ago. If you really look at these fee increases, they're targeting the lower end of our immigration group. Mm-hmm. And it's another burden being placed on low-income immigrants coming into the country, which quite honestly have been the backbone of our country since its inception. It hasn't been, yeah, I mean, having people come in on HB1 visas that are working for tech companies, that's great, and I'm not discouraging that or disparaging it. But as a country born on immigrants, basically, it's been people that fit into this criteria that have built what we are today. And this extra cost, you know, it might not sound like a lot to people, but I can tell you firsthand from people we've worked with, people we've been sitting down with, these students, $495 is a lot of money. It's the difference between some of them actually being able to pay their tuition for the next semester. You know, I wish that we could have them come in and tell their stories, but a lot of them are afraid to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get the pleasure of actually meeting some of them and hearing their stories, and it's the right thing. And you know, all of our federal delegates have to stop talking about that it's a bipartisan issue and actually make it a reality.
Yeah. So how many DACA applications have you been working on just in the last month or so since?
No, in the last month,
we've
done another round of funding. So we funded about another 20 applications right before Christmas. We have a waiting list right now. We're just because of the break, but we'll do some more starting next week.
And that's Summit County, Mo?
Yes, for
Wasatch
the most part.
As well.
Mm-hmm. We also have worked in the past with the Mexican Consul. The Mexican Consul has a program where they can pay half the fee. So if we have a student from Summit County who lives or, you know, graduated from Park City High School and is down in the valley, we'll work with them. You know, we're trying to, like, partner with as many people as possible to get the applications funded.
Okay. Where do people go to if they're interested in learning more about this? And
They could just contact me directly at moemo@utahchildren.org. They can just send me an email, and it's pretty simple.
Okay, great. We're going to have to leave it there.
Cool.
Thank you very much for coming by this morning. That's Sirik Alvarez and Mo Hickey with Voices for Utah Children.
Thanks, Carol. Happy
Thanks.
Holidays.
Yes, same to you both.